The trick is to pretend. A poem by Natalie Centers-Zapico. The ladder keeps going. The black dust that peels the paint off your car is on each rung. Don't touch your face. I imagine police with spotlights, a system to hunt my geolocation, the whirr of a drone. I had dark lines across my feet, deep scars. Where did they go? The game is who can avoid interrogation, who can split themselves into 100 coded squares, lines in alternating directions going. I want to enter this country like the rich, with the swipe of a card, a scan of the face. But they required a stomach strong enough for chemical labor. I climb, knowing the only way down is by falling. Police paved a concrete square to catch me. Men wait with high-powered hoses to spray what's left of my body down.
Review Podcast, Episode 23, A Strange Way to Live. You just heard a poem by Natalie Centers-Zapico, read by Phoebe Bridges. Later, a short story by Bud Smith, read by Connor Ratliff. A musical performance from Phoebe Bridges. A poem by Jericho Brown. And we begin with a reenactment of the Paris Review's interview with Joan Didion, with actor Jessica Hecht as Didion and Avery Truffleman as the interviewer.
It is usual for the interviewer to write this paragraph to discuss the circumstances in which the interview was conducted. But the interviewer, in this case, Linda Kuehl, died not long after these tapes were transcribed. Linda and I talked on August 18 and August 24, 1977, from about 10 in the morning until early afternoon. Both interviews took place in the living room of my husband's and my house on the ocean north of Los Angeles, a house we no longer own. The walls in that room were white. The floors were of terracotta tile, very highly polished. The glare off the sea was so pronounced in that room that the corners of it seemed, by contrast, extremely dark, and everyone who sat in the room tended to gravitate toward these dark corners. Over the years, the room had in fact evolved to the point where the only comfortable chairs were in the dark, away from the windows. I mention this because I remember my fears about being interviewed, one of which was that I would be construed as the kind of loon who had maybe 300 degrees of sea view and kept all the chairs in a kind of sooty nook behind the fireplace. Linda's intelligence dispelled these fears immediately.
Thank you. So when did you know that you wanted to write?
I wrote stories from the time I was a little girl, but I didn't want to be a writer. I wanted to be an actress. I didn't realize then that it's the same impulse. It's make-believe. It's performance. The only difference being that a writer can do it all alone. I was struck a few years ago when a friend of ours, an actress, was having dinner here with us and a couple of other writers. It suddenly occurred to me that she was the only person in the room who couldn't plan what she was going to do. She had to wait for someone to ask her, which is a strange way to live.
Let's talk a little bit about how you write. Do you have any writing rituals?
The most important is that I need an hour alone before dinner with a drink to go over what I've done that day. I can't do it in the late afternoon because I'm too close to it. Also, the drink helps. It removes me from the pages, so I spend this hour taking things out and putting other things in. Another thing I need to do when I'm near the end of the book is sleep in the same room with it. Mm. Somehow the book doesn't leave you when you're asleep right next to it.
You've said that writing is a hostile act, and I've always wanted to ask you why.
It's hostile in that you're trying to make somebody see something the way you see it, trying to impose your idea, your picture. It's hostile trying to wrench around someone else's mind that way. Quite often you want to tell somebody your dream, your nightmare. Well, nobody wants to hear about someone else's dream, good or bad. Nobody wants to walk around with it. The writer is always tricking the reader into listening to the dream.
But are you conscious of the reader as you write? Like, do you write listening to the reader listening to you?
Obviously, I listen to a reader, but the only reader I hear is me. I'm always writing to myself. So very possibly, I'm committing an aggressive and hostile act toward myself.
Y'all can clap when I walk out, that's all right. Y'all were frozen and astounded by my beauty. It's really an honor to be here with these poets at this time. Hero, she never knew one of us from another. So my brothers and I grew up fighting over our mother's mind. Like sun-colored suitors in a Greek myth, we were willing to do evil. We kept chocolate around our mouths. The last of her mother's lot, she cried at funerals, cried when she whipped me. She whipped me daily. I am most interested in people who declare gratitude for their childhood beatings. None of them took what my mother gave, waking us for school with sharp slaps to our bare thighs. That side of the family is darker. I should be grateful, so I will be. No one on earth knows how many abortions happened before a woman risked her freedom by giving that risk a name, by taking it to breast. I don't know why I am alive now that I still cannot impress the woman who whipped me into being. I turned my mother into a grandmother. She thanks me by kissing my sons. Gratitude is black. Black as a hero returning from war to a country that banked on his death. Thank God, it can't get much darker than that. Thank y'all so much.
What are the disadvantages, if any, of being a woman writer?
When I was starting to write in the late 50s, early 60s, there was a kind of social tradition in which male novelists could operate. Hard drinkers, bad livers, wives, wars, big fish, Africa, Paris, no second acts.
Yeah.
Novels by women tended to be described, even by their publishers, as sensitive. I'm not sure this is so true anymore, but it certainly was at the time, and I didn't much like it. I dealt with it the same way I deal with everything. I just tended my own garden, didn't pay much attention, behaved, I suppose, deviously. I mean, I didn't actually let too many people know what I was doing.
So what are the advantages?
The advantages would probably be precisely the same as the disadvantages. A certain amount of resistance is good for anybody. It keeps you awake.
After the break, we'll hear a short story by Bud Smith, Violets, plus music from Phoebe Bridges, when the Paris Review podcast continues.
Violets, a short story by Bud Smith, read by Connor Ratliff. A day after we made our suicide pact, the bank sent a yellow letter saying we'd lose our house. Now that night, instead of just killing ourselves, Monique and I set the place on fire. Easy to start. Mountain of rags soaked in turpentine. A solitary match. Up it went. I ducked outside. The garage door came down on its automatic track. We sat in the truck and watched the house. It was like waiting for drugs to kick in. Giddy and impatient. Doubtful. Then the smoke puffed out the garage door where the weather seal was bad. We exhaled. Shotguns were on our laps, loaded, ready to go. Economically, it would have been better to buy one gun, but then one of us would have had to see the splatter of the other. So, we financed two guns, same as cash, 90 days. We lived all the way out of town, by ourselves at the end of a dark ravine. I thought that when the fire department arrived, we'd pull our triggers. We wanted to see as much of the fire as we could. You know, it was our home. The flames appeared in the living room window. It looked like someone was having a dance party. I listened for the Bee Gees. Things got more interesting. Even now I'm aroused thinking about it. Biggest surprise of my life. I felt a rush of joy. I set my gun on the dashboard. Monique did the same. Now, since I've got you here listening, I want to properly tell about the fire. It was a work of hellish art, but inside we could see the angels twisting up. When the roof fell, orange sparks burst through the smoke. Monique gasped. clasped my hand. It was like our first date all over again. She surprised me, unzipped my fly, brought me to climax, then licked the mess off. Ash covered the windshield. I put on the wipers. We waited patiently to be arrested, but not only did the police not show, neither did a single fire engine. What did show was the sun. In the new morning light, the ground was gray like a filthy, perfect Christmas. We stared at the hissing charcoal and got excited. Excited for our future. Even just one final breakfast before they locked us up. I started the pickup and drove down our dirt road. I passed the local diner, and then the other local diner into other towns. I ventured out until I became a stranger in a Lakers jersey to all the waitresses. And Monique was just a tall, beautiful woman with blue-framed bifocals. We tossed the shotguns into the dumpster and went inside a strange diner. Ordered 7 eggs, 8 slices of bacon, buttered rye toast, coffee, and apple juice. She'd grown up on an apple farm. We always drank apple juice in solidarity. I smoked many fine cigarettes in that peach-colored booth. We made eyes at each other. Before we left, we went into the women's room, and she lifted her dress. Outside the diner, we leaned on the stone wall and looked at the nearest band of highway, which ran east and west, and at the farther one, running north and south. I leaned over and put 2 quarters in the machine, received 2 grape gumballs. She was humming my favorite song, her favorite song. I gave her a gumball and the truck keys. South, she picked. Do you know about being on the lam? It's not too hard. You pay in cash, sell your wedding rings, drive the speed limit. Don't go anywhere people rumble. Listen to Benjamin Franklin. Early to bed, early to rise. We hid in a bed and breakfast under assumed names. A big pink dollhouse that operated on the honor system. You were supposed to slip your money into this enormous piggy bank glued to the kitchen floor. I looked at the digital version of our far-off local newspaper. The fire wasn't even in there. I wanted to be presumed dead. I'm romantic like that. I loved when Huckleberry Finn went to his own funeral and watched from the rafters. I also had a soft spot for the animals he visited on the flooded island who'd made new homes in the broken-down trees and were so tame now they would eat out of anyone's hand. It must have been exciting for them to see their world so changed. Our room had the softest brass bed. I sank into it and grinned. Across the room, Monique braided her golden hair. She looked like her blood was made of candlelight again. By evening, we still hadn't made any headlines or even minor reports. I checked my phone and her phone. No one had called. We were dead as far as I was concerned, and I felt lucky. At dawn, we went farther. It's all a person can ever do. We stopped, nearly out of gasoline, at a tiny 2-story motel on the outskirts of the desert. 50 years ago, a nice place. But then the interstate was built. The nights were cold. There was a fireplace in our room. We stared at it and fucked. Maybe it's difficult to understand it. Maybe I don't understand it myself, but we'd given birth to ourselves with something as simple as fuel and a little spark. We'd burn the motel. Easy decision. Exciting prospect. An isolated, silverfish-ridden motel on the brink of nothing and nowhere. This was practice, was all. The plan after was to keep moving up. Maybe next we'd burn down a hotel. After that, a mansion. After that, we'd torch a skyscraper. Who knew? Perhaps we'd set fire to each and every wonder of the world. For two nights, we had the whole shitty motel to ourselves, just us and the lights in the sky. I was nervous enough already, and then at the last minute, right before the big burn was about to happen, another couple showed up, driving a giant Chrysler. The kind of car that looks like it ate three other cars. Michigan plates. For an hour, I saw them walk back and forth to their car, first carrying suitcases and paper bags, and then small wooden crates, each the size of a sheet cake. They were big people wearing cowboy hats, and they couldn't be totally right in the head if they had chosen to stay at that motel. At 11:30, the deskman left. He flipped the switch so the sign read "No Vacancy." He pulled his Jeep onto the road and was gone. Monique gave me a long, passionate embrace, and then she left in our truck, opposite direction, to get the fuel cans filled. I watched her dust settle in the neon and wondered if she would come back. I broke the office window and climbed inside. The chart said two rooms were occupied, room one, which was ours, and room three, which was the interlopers from the Great Lakes. Inside the register, I found no money, just tokens for the washer, dryer, and the soda machine. I grabbed all 13 keys and got to work. I did a sweep of the whole place just to make sure. Went room to room, sipping a free soda. In room seven, I found a surprise. A teenage girl, dark-haired and strung out, sleeping naked, fetal position on beige blankets, shivering. Her kit and dope there on the table. The room was a double. She was in one bed. A purple bicycle was in the other, laid sideways. That bicycle was tucked in up to its handlebars. I woke her gently, said I was about to burn down the motel. She'd better leave. She took the news well. Didn't even ask why I was doing it. I was grateful. Not having to explain was my new favorite thing. She dressed, collected her stuff. She turned the doorknob to leave. I asked, "Do you want your bicycle?" And she said, "That's not mine." I stayed in her room a while, looking at the bicycle under the covers. Then I got more intrigued and pulled the blanket back. A 10-speed. Wait, no. Even better. A 12-speed. I hadn't ridden a bike in over a decade. I went out on the balcony, lit a cigarette. I saw her walking on the road, a shadow, already far off. "Bye-bye, good luck," I mumbled. And she stopped, as if she'd somehow heard. But she just leaned over and vomited. The couple in room three were jovial in matching pajamas, white-haired with crooked faces and bright blue alcoholic eyes. I saw three empty bottles of wine. They were working on a fourth. I caught them by surprise because I had the key. They assumed I was the manager. "Oh, we're so sorry about the noise." She turned down the TV. They kept blabbering. "Come in, sit down." He poured me a drink that threatened to overflow. "Ice wine," he said. "Chateau Chantal." He reached out with both hands, steadying the cup, and I zip-tied his hands. The wine hit the carpet. He shouted and tipped over onto the bed. I tied up his wife. It was beginner's luck. I didn't know what I was doing. They misunderstood and began to plead for their lives. I told them, "Listen, I was a vegan for 4 years. I'm not even here to rob you. Please relax. I'm just a lowly arsonist." The corner of the room was full of those wooden crates stacked high. 20 or so, reminded me of when I worked at House of Pizza. I told them, "Soon we'll go somewhere safe. I'll put your suitcases in the car, then you'll go in there too, no problem." I opened the closet, and there were their cowboy hats up on the top shelf, side by side. I threw them on the bed. "You can let us live."
"I plan to, yeah." He said, "I have that disease where I can't remember people's faces." His wife shifted in her chair. He added, "She's got it too." She said, "That's right. We met at an anonymous group for people afflicted with this disease." I said, "What's the affliction called?" She laughed and said, "I don't remember." I took the woman's cell phone and looked up the disorder. Right, I don't want to butcher it. Am I saying this right? Prosopagnosia? That's right, she said. We could never tell the police what you look like. Well, much respect to you both. No one had to use the bathroom. I carried her out and placed her in that massive trunk. I put the tape over her mouth, gentle. Monique pulled up and cordially said hello to the woman, then followed me into the room carrying the fuel cans. The man took it the wrong way and began to weep. He kept asking what we'd done to Francine. Monique told him his wife was okay, and she took off her mala necklace and told him about Buddha, and how she'd made me make sure there wasn't a fish tank full of tetras or a bird cage with a parrot anywhere on premises. Not anything, an ant farm, a Venus flytrap. We would have taken any living thing to safety. As she did her mantra on the necklace and showed him how to count the beads, I asked about the crates, and the man stopped crying. He said the most peculiar thing.
We have 25,000 pieces of a million-piece puzzle.
Of what? What's the picture? He said,
I don't know.
Why is it in your room?
What if the car got stolen? He sniffled.
I held a tissue to his nose and he blew.
Thank you. We're on our way to a puzzle party at an airfield in Flagstaff. The puzzle's so big you have to look down from a hot air balloon.
Well, Monique said, that sounds very nice. When is this party?
Day after tomorrow.
You'll get there. Don't worry. Can I ask, what's your part of the puzzle?
I don't know that either. Too close, zoomed in. A teardrop, Fran thinks.
Monique opened one of the crates. Inside was a 2-foot by 3-foot section of the puzzle, assembled and mounted on cardboard, numbered on the back. He said,
our blueprint is on the table. Please don't burn it.
Monique wiped away tears of her own. A tender person. I began to load everything into their car. I filled their back seat with the crates, gave the man a pep talk, and taped his mouth. She and I carried him out, me at the heavy end, her at the feet, his ass dragged on the asphalt. Closer to the trunk, he began to thrash around. Something popped in Monique's back, loud. The man tumbled onto his wife. Monique collapsed to her knees. He floundered in the trunk. I reached down and pulled the tape off his mouth, and half his mustache came with it. He gasped,
couldn't breathe, nose clogged.
I apologized and closed the lid. Monique couldn't stand. I got down low and held her in my arms. I rubbed her shoulders and her back, and she sucked wind in and out and asked me to stop. She swore by yoga, but I'd been telling her if she wanted total defense against death, she would have to come with me to the gym. Squat, deadlift, kettlebells. I helped her to the driver's seat of our truck, and she seemed better. Could reach the pedals with her long legs. I said, I found pain pills in their room. But she wanted to be sober for the fire. Wanted to watch it clear-eyed, together. I went room to room, dousing each with the gas. Used about a quarter of a jug per room. A more conservative person could have gotten away with less. Those curtains are especially flammable. I left all the lights on, turned all the TVs on, volume up all the way. I left all the doors open. The moths flew in and then flew back out. I doused the front desk and the records kept there. I doused the candy bowl, and the bedspreads, and the carpet, and the cum stains, and the lipstick kissed onto the toilet tank in room 5. I rode the purple bicycle down the stairwell, goofing around like it was a Bronco. I really hurt my balls. Saw stars. I threw the bike into our truck bed, and Monique said, "What do you got there?" Just a souvenir. She'd made a Molotov cocktail in a glass Coke bottle. I'd lit it up, chucked it through the door to room 1, where it all began. Flames in an instant whoosh. I sat in the passenger seat next to Monique and held her hand, and it was like watching the 4th of July fireworks, or UFOs coming, or even just a sunrise. It was a green fire for a while. all that synthetic shit. And the smell was so foul, but foul is what you want sometimes. But then the flames were red and orange and finally just white as the heat got up. It began to smell like a campfire, wood smoke. It was disappointing. I was nowhere near as thrilled as the first fire, though this one was grander in scale. The transcendent feeling was absent, and my eyes darted everywhere to try and catch awe, but awe kept evading me. I looked at Monique, and she seemed completely bored. I said, "This sucks." She said, "I was going to say the same thing." Oh well, that's life. It was time to go. She started the truck and groaned. I patted her hair, gave her a kiss, and went back to the Chrysler. They were making noise in the trunk. I assured them it was almost over. Monique led the way. I followed her taillights. Soon the glow of the blaze was gone, and the night looked normal again in my rear view. A typical night that had come off the assembly line of nights. We abandoned their car in the parking lot of a food universe. I opened the glove box and read their names and address off the registration card, the insurance card. Wrote that down. Then I popped the trunk and told Glenn and Fran, "In a couple hours, you'll be like the roosters telling all the shoppers the day has begun." It was such a glorious warm night on the edge of that sweet desert. Monique and I switched. I gave her the pills and she wasn't happy to take them, but soon she was singing. Mountains appeared again. Green rain soaked the pine forest. Friendly rivers arrived. Purple sky and red roads. My, how our country changes as you blink. She was unconscious when we got back to the honor system bed and breakfast. The next morning, Monique woke up hyperventilating in that big, soft brass bed. She couldn't use her legs. She thought she'd broken her back. I didn't argue. I didn't know anything about broken backs. She kept saying she wanted to be a figure skater when she was a little girl. She asked, "Can we go to the hospital?" "Sure we can. Let's just think on it a little first." "I don't think we should have done that," she said. "Which that?" "Most of it. All of it." She asked me, "Do you think something bad will happen if we go to the hospital?" "I do, yes." We went to the ER. Every time it seemed she was just about to be seen, some person was wheeled in with massive head trauma, bleeding eyes, a heart in need of jumper cables. They gave preference to the people who arrived in ambulances, which seemed like a total scam. She slept on the filthy waiting room floor. I read an article in a home improvement magazine on how to dig a moat around your property. I wondered what prison would really be like. I'd been made to show IDs and fill out all the insurance forms. I'd long lost the job, but somehow the coverage was approved. I just figured the police were on their way, and this was how they held you there. Two orderlies finally came and loaded her on a cart. I followed into the bowels of the hospital. The technician put the lead over her and took an x-ray. The plump country club doctor screamed at me for having her walk in there. I just took the screaming. The night before, I would have set fire to the hospital. But this was a new day. The sun had come up different. 2 hours later, she was in a brace and in a wheelchair, and we were released. She'd be fine. Professional opinion? Just relax. We went to the pharmacy and got more of those same pills I'd stolen from the puzzlers. She was drugged so heavily. "I want to go home. I want to go home." She said it so consistently, I started to believe it was possible. I'd never seen her cry like that. Made me cry. Jesus. All the pain coming out. Remembering how we'd lost our jobs. How doom crept over us. Every morning we woke up to find our existences worse. I'd sold the bed, the couch, the chairs, the kitchen table. I'd sold everything. Then we slept on the floor. Her father got sicker, lost the farm. We thought the world was against us. She used to meditate 10 hours a day for an answer that never came. I drove on with the window down, arm hung out in the sunshine. The wheelchair rolled around in the bed of the truck. It was a long, funny drive. Monique opened her eyes. She recognized our town, our old neighborhood. We drove down our dirt road. Our burned-down house was just as we'd left it. No one had taken any notice. The mailbox out by the road was full of junk mail. Warnings from the cable company that they were going to cut the TV. An even yellower letter from the bank. I walked through the charred mess and stood in the backyard. Gazed over the ravine. It was a terrific place to live. I called our homeowner's insurance. Oh my God. There was a fire while we were on vacation. Monique's idea to say. And it worked. You just had to be upset. Upset with the insurance people. Upset when you talk to the police. Upset. Keep seeming upset. Be publicly upset with everything and keep praising God. In the beginning, we made the mistake of saying the Grand Cayman Islands, but that was quickly corrected to the Grand Canyon, and it stayed that way forever. The investigators still asked questions, even while the contractors reframed, re-roofed. But I think what helped was that I'd invented a pet. Hung lost dog signs all over town. Kept saying I hadn't given up hope. Champion would return. She'd smelled smoke and jumped out the window. That was the kind of dog Champion was. On the flyers, I put an Irish setter with a red bandana. I got the image off the internet. Maybe it was even your dog. Thank you. That spring, we were back in the house. New house, but the same house. They don't let you change anything. A fine house once. A fine house again. On calm nights, I rode the purple bicycle around the lip of the ravine, listened to the coyotes howl. Monique was never far behind on her bike. Sometimes she overtook me, standing, pedaling harder. She hooted and hollered with the animals. Yesterday, I stared into the flames of my barbecue grill, and I looked over at the house and wondered, how does this suddenly happen to two people? How are they suddenly happy? We used to think the world had turned against us. But no, it hadn't. All right, I want to tell you some more about Glenn and Fran from Battle Creek, Michigan. I found them on Facebook. They share an account. As I clicked back through photos, I saw them hiding Easter eggs from their grandkids. Then I saw them squinting and waving at someone taking their picture in front of a resort waterfall lit up. Pearlescent. Then I saw them standing together on a beach that looked absolutely frozen. Click back farther still, and suddenly things were green again, and they looked sunburned as though in Bliss or Hawaii. It was like I'd hoped. Meeting us had caused them no harm. A few clicks back, and there are the hot air balloons. Five in the sky,
rainbow-colored. Now a photo of a crowd of people rushing this way and that on blacktop, an airplane hangar in the background. Now a photo of Glenn and Fran in the balloon, smiling. The date on the photo was the same day Monique and I first came back to this house. I settled on a picture from way up, an aerial view. Looking down, I finally saw the subject of the million-piece puzzle, an ice cube, melting.
concludes the Paris Review podcast, episode 23, A Strange Way to Live. The pieces you heard in this episode are The Trick is to Pretend, a poem by Natalie Center-Sabico, read for us by
Phoebe Bridgers.
Violets, a short story by Bud Smith, read by
Connor Ratliff,
actor and host of the podcast Dead Eyes. The reenactment of the 1978 Art of Fiction interview with Joan Didion. The role of interviewer, Linda Keel, was performed by
Avery Truffleman,
producer and host of the podcast Nice Try. And Joan Didion was played by the actor,
Jessica Hecht.
You also heard
Hero,
a poem read by the author, Jericho Brown. This podcast is a co-production of the Paris Review and Stitcher. Our production team includes John Delore, Brendan Francis Newnham, Craig Morgan Teicher, and Laurie Dorr. Our senior producer is Helena de Groot. Executive producers are Daisy Rosario, Peter Clowney, and me, Emily Stokes. This episode was mixed and sound designed by Hannes Brown, who also composed some of the music you heard. Our podcast features original music composed and performed by a talented ensemble that includes David Sieri, Emily Wells, Mike Brown, Sam Ospovot, Rob Schwimmer, Shazad Ismaili, and Casey Holford. Our theme song is composed by David Sieri. A very special thanks to the Morgan Library and Museum, home of the archive of the Paris Review. As always, if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our full digital archive and 4 print issues featuring the very best in new poetry, prose, and interviews. This is the 5th and final episode of our 3rd season. We hope you enjoyed it, and please keep an eye on this podcast feed. There'll be more coming your way soon. I'm Emily Stokes, editor of the Paris Review. Take care.
Stitcher.